You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a 300-year-old tree in Wisconsin and find out about a chance for the public to stop by for a visit. First, analysts are expecting gas prices to rise after this weekend's attacks on oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. Drone strikes on a processing plant and a major oil field disrupted more than 5% of the world's daily crude supply. Analysts say that's the largest global disruption ever. A Yemeni rebel group claimed responsibility. The Saudi military says Iranian weapons were used in the attack. The U.S. said the assault appeared to originate in Iran or Iraq. NPR News will keep bringing us updates on the latest on the international front. For now, we'll find out what the disruption could mean for consumers. Jim Ritterbusch is the president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm based in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Now, in terms of what consumers here in the United States might feel, how big a deal is this attack?
It's a big deal. It's not as big a deal as some of the events we've seen in the past, such as the situation in Kuwait in 1990. But we have seen crude prices pop about $7.50 here today per barrel. And at one point, we had gasoline futures up 20 cents in the futures. I don't look for that to fully translate to the pump, but I think you could see 10 or 12 cents up by next week.
By next week. I've read that gas prices usually go down a little bit in the fall after the summer travel season. Is that true?
That's true, but I think we've already seen that that seasonal downdraft, and from here it looks like we're going to swing things back up because of the Saudi drone attacks.
How much of the oil that we use here in the United States in one form or another actually comes to us from Saudi Arabia? Do we use a lot of that actual oil?
We use a lot of it, but compared to five, 6 years ago, our imports of Saudi Arabian crude are down appreciably from more than 2 million barrels a day to somewhere around 400,000 or 500,000 barrels a day. So we've seen a reduction of around 70% or so, and that's mainly attributable to the increased shale oil production here in the United States.
Do we see oil prices after an incident like this go up maybe even more than would be expected by the damage done because of, concern among investors, some speculating that it might go up and there's a self-fulfilling prophecy there?
Yeah, and that's perceptive because we tend to pump what we call geopolitical risk premium into the market. And if the market's going to assume that if Iran or the Yemen, the Houthis did this particular act, they could possibly do it again. So this was something that had not been expected. And since it is now a strong possibility, then we're going to keep prices elevated for some time, in my opinion. The extent and the duration of the lost supply out of Saudi Arabia is yet to be defined, and we're probably a couple of weeks away before it is.
Yes, Saudi Arabia seemed to indicate that they could have everything. They'll have oil to fill in for the oil loss. They'll have things back online pretty quickly. I've seen more skeptical voices. How do we assess how long it's going to take to repair after kind of an unprecedented attack like this?
It's going to take days, possibly a couple of weeks before we get a good assessment of the damage done. This was big. It's a huge oil field, probably the largest in the world. And the infrastructure that supports that is substantial. So it's going to take some time. So I think the Saudis were a bit optimistic in suggesting that they would quickly bring things right back up to prior capacity.
Talking to Jim Ritterbusch from Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois. Jim, is there any question that, some place in the world, whether it's the United States or elsewhere, is actually going to be short on supply? It's not just that the cost will go up, but somebody's going to see disruptions caused by not having enough oil accessible?
I don't think so. This time around, we've got several mitigating factors that will help to preclude sustained price advances to the real lofty levels. For instance, we're sitting on ample supplies currently. I would say on a global basis, we're a bit above average levels. The Saudis, prior to this event, had some extra productive capacity that they can employ. There's a couple of OPEC producers that have been producing above their assigned quota levels, such as Iraq and Nigeria. They'll keep pushing, pumping full out. And despite what Russia indicated today, that they would keep levels unchanged, I think they'll probably be lifting output a notch and helping to fill some of this void. And as importantly, I think that you're going to see some release of strategic petroleum reserves by the United States and possibly by the International Energy Agency out of Paris.
Right. President Trump was talking about that idea of tapping into the strategic petroleum reserve. Can you talk about that that backstop that we maintain here in the United States? What is it?
Well, it's about 645 million barrels of crude that's stored in some of these underground caverns down in some of the southern states. And technically, it's not easy to extract those barrels, but in emergency, they can be pulled out of there. Furthermore, it makes economic sense to release these crude spread curve, which indicates sequential prices going out into the future, is what we call inverted, and just going out about 6 months. Crude prices are about $4 lower than they are currently. So barrels could be released from a strategic reserve and replaced later at a lower price.
What are you watching for next, Jim, as we watch, as we assess the damage in Saudi Arabia and watch prices? What are the next next items you're watching for to see where this is all going to go?
Well, what we have to depend on are the indications out of Saudi Arabia. I mean, they're not as transparent as we are when it comes to providing information when there's been somewhat of a catastrophe. So what we have to rely on is indications from them, and there might be some satellite images that might give us an indication of what's going on over there. So that's what we will be watching. But also on the other side of the coin, if we see prices continue to advance, there's going to be some demand deterioration. And many global economies have already seen a significant slowing in economic growth, and this could exacerbate that process. And you could see some oil demand weakening that will offset at least a part of the supply loss or the price gains that have been prompted by that loss.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Jim Ritterbusch is the president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois. We talked to them about the weekend attacks on Saudi Arabian oil facilities and what they could mean for consumers. Coming up, the story of a 300-year-old tree that's still standing in Waukesha County. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a woman who's been looking after a bur oak tree in Wisconsin that's more than 300 years old. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about two sisters who have been forced apart.
Family separation can be extremely traumatic, especially for children. At Camp Tobelong, Wisconsin, brothers and sisters who have been separated by the foster care system have an opportunity to spend time together once again. WPR's Alana Watson introduces us to a pair of sisters who stayed at the week-long camp in Plymouth.
Siblings in the foster care system are separated for different and painful reasons. While each situation is unique, the feeling of being taken from their home and their siblings is something these campers have in common.
We always leave going away from this knowing that you're not the only one going through something like this. You're not the only one hurting. You're not the only one that can't talk about it with people. But you can talk about it with these people because they've been through the same thing.
That's 17-year-old Priscilla. Her 16-year-old sister Raya is sitting next to her. The two sisters live apart. We're not using their last name to protect their privacy.
We were taken out of the home. I was 7 and she was 5.
6.
Going five. To be 6.
Yeah, so 5.
They have 5 other siblings. Some of them have been coming to Camp Tubalong for 4 years, but a few haven't had the opportunity. I talked to them in the camp's mess hall. Priscilla hit the table while telling her story.
It was very confusing. Like, random people came to our door and they're like, get your stuff, we're leaving. I was like, I don't know you. Like, why? What? What's going on? And we were all separated, and it was really hard because I didn't know where they were.
They were separated shortly after their youngest brother, Jack, was born.
He was born addicted to cocaine.
The majority of Priscilla's and Raya's siblings have been adopted and live in different homes, except their little brother. He was just given back to their birth mother.
And it was very confusing as to why, because she had 6 other kids that were all terminated rights, even though she was ready for it, which I didn't think she was. Like, when you have so many kids that you can't take care of, then what makes them think that you're going to be able to take care of this one kid?
Honestly, though, I felt like it was a little bit harder for me since I did live with him.
Oh, yeah.
And I, through those 4 years, I really created a really big bond with him. And, like, we do, like, everything together with Jack. And he was, like, my little buddy. It hurt the fact that our mother was once again, like, interfering in our life and what we needed with our siblings. And it was really hard to get over. And not completely over it.
Unfortunately, that's not the only sibling they're separated from. Priscilla and Raya also don't see one of their sisters. They believe her adoptive parents have cut ties.
I've heard so many things, like, that she cut us off and that, like, she doesn't want us to talk to her. And it just hurts because we didn't do anything to them.
The teenage sisters are still trying to understand and accept their family history and their relationship with their mother.
I won't ever, ever, ever forgive her for what, like, she did to, like, our family and stuff. Like, I feel like when you have kids, you have a responsibility, and you have to be big enough to choose the right thing for you and the children you have. And if you couldn't took care of them, you have to give them away. Like, you have to do what's right for your kid, and you can't be selfish.
Just say, like, I can't only forgive you because you took the one hope in, like, our family away from us.
No.
Honestly, like, she just, like, ruined the last how many years of my life.
I wouldn't even say that. I would love her still. Like, she's not my mom. She's not the person that raised me to be a good person. She's not the person that helps me do right from wrong or learn things. That's what a mom is. It's not who gave birth to you. It's the person that guides you through your life and is there for you, and she wasn't there.
WPR's Alana Watson brought us that story of two sisters who go to Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin, a camp that reunites siblings separated by the foster care system. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, 3 centuries ago, a tree was growing in Waukesha County. That tree is still with us, a bur oak, and it's one of, if not the biggest of its kind in the state. It's located on private property, so the public doesn't normally get to check out this historic tree, but a conservation event in a few weeks will give people a chance to see it. Tizza Meyer has been looking after the tree, which is standing in the middle of the farm she owns. Tizza, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we've been saying this tree is old, but how old is this tree we're talking about?
Well, actually, it was decided that the tree was an acorn in 1711 by a climatologist. Pardon?
1711.
1711, yes. It's over 300 years old and still healthy and still doing well.
And I'm sorry I interrupted. You were starting to say how they figured out it was that old. How do we know that?
Well, in 1988, some climatologists from the University of Wisconsin in Madison decided to do some borings on some old trees to see if they could check on climate change. And they decided that there were 12 very old trees on this farm. So they came in and did borings on those 12 trees. All 12 of them turned out to be over 200 years old, but the champion by far was the one that is beautiful here outside my home.
Well, describe this tree. What does it look like if we're standing next to it and under it, I guess?
Well, I like to think of it as a giant elephant foot. It's 23 feet around the base, and it's over 60 feet tall. But most of these trees, the bur oak tree, grows very similarly to the live oak of the South. They are very muscular, and their branches will go all the way to the ground if you leave them to grow as they will. Unfortunately, most people prune them somewhat to get under them or whatever, but they're beautiful, beautiful, healthy, strong, muscular trees.
How does it feel to be, you know, just hang out in your yard with something that is, you know, 300 years old, three times older than any human in the world, the oldest human?
Well, I like to think of this as history. Actually, the tree has been here since the Revolutionary War. It has seen so much history. It has seen the Native Americans, the first settlers, the first loggers, the first farmers, and I wish it could tell me those stories. Sometimes I make up my own because I have an idea of what she has seen, but I refer to her as C. She still produces acorns, and I call her the queen.
You're an artist yourself, I understand. Are you inspired by the queen?
Oh, absolutely. I'm inspired very much by the property in general. There are many, many old oak trees here, and the first settler was a man from Wales. So he was from a rocky land, and we are right at the edge of where the glacier dropped the stones. So we're in the terminal moraine, and the farm has actually 4.5 miles of the thrown farmer stone fences on it. Each 18 to 20 acres is divided by the stones that were thrown out of the fields. And a lot of the oak trees are growing near those stones, and they were not disturbed because they were not needed to be cleared for the farmer.
Now, people in a few weeks in an afternoon, they'll get an opportunity to see the queen and I think some of these other really old trees on your property. Can you tell us about the Waukesha County Land Conservancy's Oaktoberfest?
Well, the Oaktoberfest is a little celebration. Actually, it's probably going to turn out to be a big celebration, but we're celebrating the oak trees because it's very necessary for us to have these trees. They give us virtually the air we breathe, and many of the different species of oaks have fallen to disease, the white oaks and the red oaks. And so far, the bur oak has been healthy, and we want to keep it that way. So the Waukesha Land Conservancy, as well as some people from northern Illinois, are very much in keeping with helping these trees to survive. Sorry there, I had a little break.
That's okay. Now, can you tell us
one of the things that happened that really was so intriguing to me? Not long after we bought this farm, my doorbell rang, and there was a gentleman there with about an 8 or 10-year-old little boy. And he said, "I understand you have the champion bur oak tree. Do you mind if we look at it and photograph it?" And I said, "No." And I said, "Are you spending the day with your son looking at trees?" And he said, "Actually, we're spending the summer looking at trees. We're going around to see all of the champion trees of every species in Wisconsin." And I couldn't help but think of how many children know of all the sports champions, but how many really know about the champions of Mother Nature. It was very impressive to me.
Wow. What does it mean for it to be a champion bur oak?
It has to be the biggest. It doesn't necessarily have to be the oldest, but it has to be the biggest. Fortunately for me, mine is also the oldest, biggest and the oldest.
Can you tell us the story of when you first moved onto the farm and discovered all these trees?
Well, actually, I'd been looking for some land. I wanted something like 20 acres. However, I kept looking, and I didn't find anything that appealed, and something told me that I would find something that had some spirit and would speak to me. And there was a tiny ad in the paper one Sunday morning, and I told my husband, I don't know, it's 160 acres. I think we ought to check it out. It's more than we want, but we ought to look. We came out here. We were the first people to arrive. And when we parked the car, it had been raining, and suddenly there was a rainbow. And I opened the car door, and a bluebird sat on the door. And it was like some kind of an omen to me. And then I saw the central lane of this farm with all of these old oak trees, and it just spoke to me. It was a very spiritual thing. And I think oftentimes in our lives, there are things that touch us in many ways. And this farm did that for me. And I knew that I had to get in here, restore some buildings, and keep it alive.
What do you think about when you think of all the people who have been on the land before you, from natives to that Welsh farmer to all the other people who have worked on that farm but left those trees where they were?
I think that I have great reverence for them. The farmer who had this farm before we bought it loved the trees, and he had little kids that would come out here, and one of the things that he had them do was join hands and see how many of them it would take to go around the big tree. And people still tell me about that. Those children are grown up now, but some of them are neighbors. And they say, oh, we remember Mr. Northey, and how often he would have us come out and say, okay, hold hands and see how many it takes.
Now, you're the landowner of this property, but I understand you don't think of yourself as the owner of these trees.
I really don't. I feel that Mother Nature provides all of us with absolute wonder. And for me, it makes me feel so good that I can share some of this with other people. None of us take anything with us when we leave this earth. We'll all go away someday. That's part of Mother Nature's plan. But I do feel that anything we have on this earth that is spectacular as this tree should be shared. I love sharing it.
Tizza, thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That's Tizza Meyer, who co-owns Stone Fences Farm in Waukesha County. We talked to her about a 3-century-old tree still standing on her property. Coming up, the Trump administration is repealing clean water rules made under President Obama. We'll find out more about what's changing. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, a new round of student testing scores are out in Wisconsin with some results that have people worried. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a Department of Public Instruction official about the latest efforts to measure student performance here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency announced last week that it's repealing a 2015 act signed by President Obama that expanded the scope of wetlands and waterways protected under the Clean Water Act. The agency plans to write new guidelines later this year. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler claimed the old rules were too broad and costly for farmers, miners, and developers. It's the latest example of environmental deregulation from the Trump administration. It has also loosened rules on methane and carbon emissions and taken the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. Pat Parento is professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. Pat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Take us first back to this 2015 change in the late years of the Obama administration. What did those new rules do?
Well, they were designed to clarify the meaning of this term, waters of the United States, which has been a very controversial subject for a very long time. And the United States Supreme Court has sort of made a muddle of trying to interpret and apply that. And in the latest decision from 2006, in this infamous Rapanos case, the Supreme Court actually called upon EPA and the Corps of Engineers to issue a new rule, clarifying the scope of their jurisdiction. So that's what lay behind the 2015 rule. It was an attempt to clarify a term of the statute that has led to a lot of litigation.
So there were gray areas when it came to which waterways and bodies of water were protected and which ones weren't. Do I have that right?
Correct. That's right.
And what does...
And the courts, frankly, one of the things that's confusing is that the 2015 rule has been characterized as expanding the scope of jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. That's really not accurate. The cases that have interpreted that term extended it throughout the entire tributary system of all the navigable waters of the United States. And so it's really a question of how do you draw the line where federal jurisdiction ends and state jurisdiction begins? And that's not an easy matter to do with the complexity of watersheds.
And when we say protection, what are these waterways protected from?
They're protected primarily from direct discharges of pollutants, some of which are conventional, like nutrients, phosphorus and nitrogen, that are causing one of the most serious water quality impairment problems in the United States. That's what gives you the blue-green algae infestations that are affecting a lot of water bodies, but also toxics, metals, and mercury and other heavy metals that are discharged from industrial sources. So the statute is primarily aimed at those sources of pollution that you can identify, pipes and ditches and conduits. It also deals with non-point source pollution. It doesn't regulate, that's runoff from farms and fields and so forth. It doesn't regulate those sources through a permit, but it does provide money through a revolving fund for states to use to employ best management practices and other things. Statute also provides a program to deal with spills from pipelines, gas pipelines, oil pipelines, terminals, storage tank facilities, and those can cause some very serious water quality problems. So if you lose federal jurisdiction over the water, you're going to lose a lot of the controls that the Clean Water Act provides.
Under this new decision from the Trump administration's EPA, what changes now? What changes as compared to that 2015 revision?
So the repeal is the first step, and that, of course, is going to be challenged. A bunch of states have already announced their intentions to sue to challenge the determination that the 2015 rule was unjustified or an overreach by the federal government. So we don't know exactly whether this repeal is going to withstand judicial scrutiny. So that's point number one. Then the following rule will be the replacement rule. And according to President Trump's directive to Administrator Wheeler at EPA, the new rule is designed to be modeled on Justice Scalia's opinion in this Rapanos case, which is very narrow. It applies only to relatively permanent bodies of water and to wetlands that are connected by a surface connection to traditionally navigable waters, large waters. So the new rule, in short, is going to shrink the jurisdiction of the federal government by a very significant amount. It's hard to quantify because if you look across the United States, of course, you're going to see a very different situation with watersheds in the West, where a lot of the streams are actually dried up much of the year and they have much less rainfall and so forth. So in those kinds of areas, this rule could have a really major impact. Arizona, for example, 90% of the water bodies in Arizona are what they call ephemeral. Well, the Trump administration has now said in this proposed rule, ephemeral waters will not be protected, and a lot of wetlands also will not be protected.
Talking to Pat Parento from Vermont Law School, looking at changes from the EPA under the Trump administration, changing the rules that regulate water pollution, emissions that go into certain kinds of waterways, changing a rule set in 2015 under the Obama administration. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Pat, I know when this 2015 ruling came down, there were complaints here in Wisconsin and elsewhere that it protected what people said were puddles, in effect, things that might be wet for a small part of the year but weren't really a key part of the U.S. water system. Was there something to that complaint?
No. The rule actually, in one of the very first sentences, says this rule does not apply to puddles or artificial water bodies or fountains or swimming pools. I mean, EPA went out of its way to address those comments and criticisms. And the rule, if you read it, simply doesn't regulate those kinds of waters. EPA did a very exhaustive scientific study It was the first time that all of the literature on the value of these ups, these headwater streams, the smaller streams, and the associated wetlands, were how valuable were they to maintaining water quality downstream in the lakes and rivers that we all recognize. And the science was very clear. If you don't protect these headwater streams, you're not going to be able to protect downstream water resources. You're not going to be able to protect a lot of the source water for public water supplies. Something like two-thirds of public water supplies in the nation come from headwater streams. So EPA was driven by science to extend the reach of the federal jurisdiction. It did draw bright lines limiting federal jurisdiction for the first time. The rules that have been on the books never really said exactly where federal jurisdiction ends. One thing about the 2015 rule, you can argue with it if you want, of course, but it did do that. It drew lines and said our jurisdiction is going to end at this point. What people objected to was the fact that it looked like EPA was expanding its jurisdiction, and really what it was doing is trying to clarify where it ended. But people can still say, we don't think we should have federal regulation. Okay, then the question is, who is going to regulate these waters? The Trump administration says the states will do it. But I've done research and published it that shows that 27 states have on their books laws that say their jurisdiction and their regulations will not be any stricter or broader than the federal regulations. So when you lose federal control, you're going to lose state control in those states, unless those state legislatures can be persuaded to create a regulatory program to replace the one that's being removed by the Trump administration.
We heard from Wisconsin Speaker, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in a statement. He said, I applaud the Trump administration for taking the first step toward reversing this clear federal overreach. He says the states deserve to have jurisdiction over their own water resources. So a Republican leader in the Wisconsin legislature saying this is federal overreach. What do you say to that concern?
Well, the Clean Water Act doesn't prevent the states from asserting jurisdiction and protecting their waters any way they want. The federal rules only create a floor of protection, not a ceiling. And that's important because unless there's a floor of protection across the United States, downstream states are going to have no control over what kind of pollution is coming down to them from upstream states. Interstate pollution can only be controlled by EPA. But the Clean Water Act doesn't prevent states from taking over permit programs and administering them, from setting their own standards, from investing in non-point source pollution controls, from preventing water quality problems before they become serious. There's nothing in federal law that stops the states from doing any of that. What these states that want to see the rollback are saying is, we don't want any control over these water bodies unless we decide to have that control. And of course, that's what the argument is. I mean, are we going to have a floor of protection that's nationwide that protects all of the waters, or are we going to have a patchwork? Some places it'll be good, other places it won't. That's the world that we had before the 1972 Clean Water Act was passed, by the way. The reason Congress enacted this comprehensive law was because there was a total failure of achieving water quality standards when it was left to the individual states. We may be going back to that.
We're talking to Pat Parento, professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this change from the Trump administration that will effectively, it sounds like, narrow the scope of protected waterways under the Clean Water Act? Are you a farmer or a business owner who's had to deal with protected bodies of water on land you are on or near? Are you concerned by the growing list of environmental deregulation from President Trump's EPA? And do you think that Wisconsin can do a good enough job protecting its own water without a floor in federal law? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Pat Parento, professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. We're looking at the EPA's effective repeal of clean water protections from the Obama era. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the Trump administration moving to protect, in effect, fewer bodies of water? If you have had experience with clean water laws as part of your business in your community, what do you think? Do you have water issues that you worried there isn't enough enforcement on right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Becky is with us in Baldwin. Becky, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that as if the Trump administration makes the EPA less protections and it goes to the states, well, the state of Wisconsin was a year ago just made the waters of the state less protected. So when it comes to our waters, our public waters, I feel they were decrease in quality as we already have a water quality problem.
Becky, thanks for the call. Pat, Becky worried that less federal oversight means worse water quality over time.
Well, I think that's true. Maybe not in every instance. And I don't know the Wisconsin situation as well as Becky and others. But I can say that without the ability of the federal government to do the research that's required to establish standards so we know how to protect public health and what technologies will do that, what you're asking individual states to do is shoulder an enormous responsibility. When I was Commissioner of Environmental Quality in Vermont, a third of my staff was paid for through federal programs. If you take federal programs away, you're taking federal money away, federal technical assistance away, in addition to federal regulations. So it's not just the permit process. It's all the things that you need to do to achieve and maintain water quality.
Becky, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. The Trump administration has rolled back environmental regulations and therefore the protection of our environment. I'm very concerned about this. These Wisconsin legislators who are Republicans will not do anything to protect the environment any more than what this legislation might do, because they're really just pandering to their wealthy donors, unfortunately. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joan, thanks for the call. Pat, Joan referenced other deregulation efforts when it comes to environmental issues. Big picture, what are you seeing as the trend under the Trump administration?
Well, it's unprecedented. I mean, it's really across the board. You touched on it earlier. It's air quality, water quality, hazardous waste disposal, cleaning up toxic coal ash pits all over Appalachia and other parts of the country, rolling back emission controls for methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, opposing the Clean Power Plan, replacing it with a plan that will cost a lot of money, not do very much, and even by EPA's own estimation, result in tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths every year. The list goes on. It's very discouraging. And it doesn't seem to have any end. It seems like everything that the Obama administration had done, no matter what it was, the Trump administration is going to undo. And sometimes in ways that the courts are finding unlawful. The Trump administration has a terrible track record in court. And some of these changes to the Clean Water Act may not survive legal challenge because they make a lot of mistakes. They don't take account of the science. They've got an anti-science kind of bias throughout the agency of federal government right now. So it's kind of a bleak picture right now, to be honest, and I'd like to see us get beyond that.
Thanks for that call, Joan, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Pat Parento from Vermont Law School, looking at Trump administration efforts to repeal a change to water protection laws from 2015 under the Obama administration. We'll go now to Karen with us in Ashland. Karen, hi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, when we look around the country and even around the world and we see, like in Florida, big sugar destroying the waterways there. And I know that, like in South America, Coca-Cola is taking water away from people who are in drought conditions and putting that dirty water. How do we engage? And what organizations do we engage to stop this kind of environmental terrorism?
Karen, thanks for the call. Pat, I know there's a process for rules changes like this. Is there still a citizen input time going on here?
Well, the comment period on the proposed replacement rule for the Clean Water Rule has closed. So unfortunately, no. You can always contact your representatives in Congress. There is a law called the Congressional Review Act, which authorizes by a joint resolution Congress to disapprove a rule. There are some members of Congress who are interested in using that tool. It's probably unlikely that Congress, both houses of Congress, would step in and stop a rule like this, but it is one outlet people have to express their disapproval if that's the way they feel with what's going on. Beyond that, as I say, there's going to be litigation. This issue is not going to be resolved during President Trump's first, and I would have to say, I hope only, term of office. So this thing is going to continue for a while. There will be opportunities in the future, I think, to restore, if we do lose some of these protections, to restore them, to improve the Clean Water Act, to make it more effective. If there are serious problems with the way it's being administered, address those problems and fix them. But don't do it at the expense of making progress on clean water. If anything, we're losing ground in that area, and we need to do better.
Karen, thanks for the call. Dave joins us now in Green Bay. Dave, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for letting me on. I just want to comment that I just spent, my profession is to clean up these here major spills when they happen. And I can tell you firsthand that we don't need to deregulate. We need to at least stay where we're at. And as far as the wetlands, we need those for just watch the news. We need them when we have all these major storms. That water has to go somewhere, and we need clean water to drink. So I think it's a bad idea what the Republicans are doing.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Pat, we've mostly been talking about the flowing waterways and lakes. Can you talk about the wetlands and how they fit into this? You touched on that a little earlier.
Yeah, the caller is exactly right. Wetlands are sponges. They are our primary flood control mechanism that nature's provided us for free. We've destroyed over half of the wetlands in this country, a lot of it by agriculture, frankly. And we desperately need all the wetlands we can get, frankly, to manage this climate-altered world we're living in. Just look at that horrendous incident with Hurricane Harvey in Houston that dropped 50 inches of rain on the city in 2 days and overwhelmed completely its ability to manage water. We need these wetlands both for water storage, also for water quality, for carbon sequestration, for fish and wildlife habitat. Wetlands are tremendous assets, natural assets. And we need to be restoring them, not losing them.
Thanks for that call, Dave. In our last minute, what are you watching for next when it comes to clean water rules and other environmental protections?
Oh, boy, I'm not looking at anything positive right now. But, I mean, the next fight will be over this replacement rule. And so people can stay tuned and see when that rule becomes final and what its fate is in court. And is there going to be an opportunity down the road to recapture some of this? In the meantime, like I said before, if states like Wisconsin or other states want to do more with regulating and protecting their water bodies, fine. Please do that. Go to your legislature, write letters to your editor, get your neighbors involved, find out what's happening in your own community. Where does your water supply come from? I'll bet a lot of people don't really know where their water is coming from and what condition it may be in and what threats there are that need to be addressed before they become really serious. There's a lot that people can do if they want to.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Pat Parento is a professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. He talked with us about the EPA's move to repeal Obama-era rules that protected wetlands and waterways under the Clean Water Act. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of people are hardcore fans of particular actors or musicians or other kinds of celebrities. But our guest says now fan culture is moving into a new realm. It's sweeping the world of American politics. And that's not always a good thing, she writes. We'll find out more and you can share your thoughts. The Great Recession had an impact around the nation, but some places bounced back faster than others. A new study tries to find out what makes a community more resilient in the face of economic downturns and how to use that information to prepare for the future. We'll talk to one of the authors of that study. and a music writer looks at the best music of the 2010 decade. That's this one. It's coming to a close in not too long. We'll look at some of the best from different genres of the music world, and you will be able to join in and share some of your favorites. I think we're going to give some listens to those pieces of music as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:15, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joins the show for a look at some of the top issues facing the country. That's tomorrow at 7:15 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a legal expert about why parents may want to think twice about what they post about their kids online. You can post online about not the kids, but about the topic. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.